Hi, thank you, Ken. And I realize that was an audio you just played. Kate's not here, but I want to say thank you, Kate. That was a very clear teaching. I think Kate's teachings are very clear. And we do keep all of her teachings in a YouTube playlist. So if you were to go to the Awakening Together channel and then click on playlist, you'll find a Kate Greaves playlist. And we keep all of her teachings there. You can also get to it by going to the Awakening Together website underneath audios and videos, sanctuary highlights. When you find the Kate Greaves page, it has a link to her YouTube channel or to our YouTube playlist of her YouTubes. So yeah, Kate's always very clear. We're really lucky to have some very, very clear teachers here in Awakening Together, and Kate is one of them. So hi everyone, happy Sunday. Can you guys believe that this is the last Sunday in June already? That's just amazing to me. I think I both work and play hard in the summer. I work hard in the winter, but I work and play hard in the summer, and so it just goes by like in a blink of an eye because, you know, when you use up every single minute, the minutes go by very, very quickly. So I'm really shocked that we're only about a little over a week away from celebrating July 4th here, which to me is the middle of the summer. That's what July 4th always represents, the middle of the summer. Even though this isn't true, I perceive Memorial weekend as the beginning of summer, July 4th as the middle, and Labor Day weekend as the end. But of course that's not the truth. Summer actually just started last week and it goes all the way till near the end of September, right? So we are here now for the seven steps to awakening. And tonight I will be starting with quote number 770. But before I begin, I'm going to play a song. This is one of my favorite surrender songs. It's Mike Scott and the Waterboys. I'm sure you guys have heard this song before. It's called What Do You Want Me to Do?
To do things my own way, and I've tried to do what people say, and I'm going nowhere fast, and I'm turning to you at last. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do, Lord? I can see the lights of home, but I can't get there on my own. I can see the landing strip, but I need you to steer my ship. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do, Lord? Show me how. I'll begin right now. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do, Lord? What do you want me to do, Lord? Do you want me to
Isn't that a great song? I think it is. All right, so let me give you guys a link, those of you who like to read along with the journal. I'm posting that link in the room now. Voila, there you go. And I'm going to begin by reading quote 770 from the Seven Steps to Awakening. This is Sri Shankara. One's true self shines forth again when the contamination is removed. One's true self shines forth again when the contamination is removed. And I guess a part of what I want to say here is, with all of my heart, what I would wish for every person is that they remove the contamination of the ego from their perception. We don't see just how much the ego distorts our perception until the contamination is removed. If people knew just how much the ego was distorting their perception, I believe that they would get rid of it very, very quickly. The problem is the one who has a contaminated mental filter doesn't know that the mental filter is contaminated. That one doesn't realize that her seeing is distorted. She believes that her perception is correct or right. And so she fights for her perception rather than letting go of contamination. And the truth is, it is heartbreaking to observe people who are fighting with one another, who are suffering from the I am bad belief, who are worried about imaginary futures, or who live with grievances from the past. When none of that has to be. It's literally choosing unhappiness when unhappiness doesn't have to be chosen. And so it's sad. And yet it's what almost everyone does. Even people on the spiritual path. Even people who study these teachings and contemplate these teachings on a daily basis. When it comes right down to their daily life, and somebody says something they don't like, for example, they just go with all of the ego thoughts and all of the ego reaction, and they don't stop and question why. What's on, Jasmine? Is it hailing? Oh, yeah. It is. Yeah.
Are you teaching?
I am teaching.
Sorry.
It's okay. We're experiencing hail right now. Yeah, that was enough anyway. The other day a couple days ago I made a post in Sharing and Contemplation that said something like, how do you know when you move from a spirituality that is purely intellectual? And the answer is when you begin practicing it. You know, the answer is when somebody says something you don't like, and instead of going off into your conditioning and reacting in whatever way you do, whether that's yelling at them or then avoiding them or, you know, feeling all bad yourself like you're the guilty one or whatever your conditioning is, when instead of that, you notice that that conditioning is ego, you do nothing except rest, accept, and trust and let it pass. That's when you know your practice has moved beyond an intellectual practice to a genuine practice. When you begin living your life from the desire to end the ego and choosing never to act from ego. And I was talking to a friend about this the other day, and I told her, I said, you know, the rule is never. I said, everybody fails. You know, like, everybody listens to their ego sometimes, right? I said, but the rule still has to be never, because the rule can't be sometimes, right? The rule can't be don't listen to your ego sometimes. It has to be, you know, never, never listen to your ego. And then when we make the mistake, we just correct ourselves as quickly as possible. But to the degree that we believe our thoughts and believe our perceptions, which is listen to ego. To the degree that we believe our thoughts and believe our perceptions, that is to the degree that the contamination remains in us. The only way to be free of the contamination is to recognize it as contamination when it arises, and then to choose not to speak or act from that. So again, the quote, one's true self shines forth again when the contamination is removed. So that means that our commitment is to removing the contamination. The way A Course in Miracles says something is that love cannot be taught, but that our function is to remove all of the blocks. To love's presence, right? That's the contamination. That's our function. And again, the way that we remove it is by not enlivening it with our attention and belief. So we simply do not act or speak from it. And again, it's actually a little more than that, because let's say I had a grievance against someone. We'll call him Fred. Let's say I had a grievance against Fred. It really wouldn't be enough to never tell Fred what I think of him, you know, to never tell him off, to be quiet, and to never take actions to get Fred out of my life, to not act, if in my mind I'm still telling myself the story over and over again of what Fred did. So it's really more than not speaking and not acting. It's also not thinking with. We have to choose not to speak from ego, not to act from ego, and not to think with ego. To remove our attention from that ego thinking. And that's how we remove the contamination. That's the opposite of enlivening it. It's, as Tess Hughes said, putting it on a diet, or as I often say, starving it. It's starving the ego, because the ego thrives on our attention and our belief. So when we don't give our attention, our belief, we are starving it. That is to remove the contamination. Again, the quote says, "One's true self shines forth again when the contamination is removed." So I'm going to go and look at the journal and see what I wrote. I was contemplating this quote on March 4th, 2014, and here is what I wrote. "There is still fear here. I feel it now. For a time it was most obvious, and then it became less. Now it remains subtle and not fully believed. It can even be ignored, as wisdom is chosen over fear. But it is here. I can feel it. What is the cause of this fear? What am I afraid of? Who is afraid? And what am I?" It's funny because I was actually just contemplating this. It seems like yesterday. It could have been this morning. Recently. I'll just say recently. I was just contemplating, or maybe realizing is a better word, that there's still fear here, just like this says. It's not like I live in a constant state of fear. And in fact, you could say compared to the average psyche in the world today, I am much more fearless than the average psyche. You know, I don't worry about the future. I don't, worry about Jasmine when she's gone away to college or when she goes out with her friends. Or I don't, today Jamie's legs quit working while we were hiking. Her legs just quit. I didn't worry about Jamie even in that moment. You know, I mean, there was just no worry there. So in that way, I'm much more fearless than the average person because, these are circumstances under which the average person does go into worry, does go into psychological fear. But I know that there's still fear here, and the contemplation or the realization that arose in the mind was something needs to push up this fear. Something needs to make this fear rise up so that it can be let go. And that doesn't mean that I'm going to do anything. You know, I always think it's foolish when people, like if I was to go and jump out of an airplane, for example, when I feel no calling to jump out of an airplane, just to push up the fear. I don't even know if it works in that way. When we consciously try to push up these things, I don't even know if that works. To be honest, I think somehow that might just recycle. That's my intuitive feeling. It's more like we just recognize that healing still needs to happen. We have absolute willingness for that healing. We trust it will come at the right time. But again, we remain aware that it's going to have to happen at some time. And when it does, I want to meet it with a healing attitude. So, I don't know what will push up this fear. And, oh, my goodness, the contemplation is like coming back to me now like a ton of bricks. I had kind of forgotten it except for the edge, but now it's coming back to me like a ton of bricks. What came to me was kind of a parallel to Jesus' life. Because early in Jesus's known spiritual path, they have what they call the missing years, where we don't really know what happened in Jesus's life, and people have a lot of theories, between the age of when he was about 12 and when he was about 30. We don't really know, but I don't pay any attention to theories. I mean, I really just don't care. So if we get to the part that appears to be known, the part that's recorded for us in the Bible. We have early in Jesus' path where he is baptized, and that baptism could represent a beginning. The baptism is a decision, so that could represent the beginning of the spiritual path. And then the very next thing he does after this beginning is he goes into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, and he goes through this intense purification. And after the beginning of my path, which began in April of 2004, I went through what I call 5 years of intense purification. So my 40 days and 40 nights in the desert were actually, hold on, let me, just for the fun of it. And of course, 5 years is an estimate, but let's take 5 times 365. Okay, so I had 1,825 days and night in the desert. So my his was 40 days and 40 nights. Mine was 1,825 days and 1,825 nights. And a lot of purification occurred, just like it did with Jesus. And so since then, you know, comparatively to before, right, there is, you know, significantly less fear. And this is why I lead a pretty happy life, because you can't be in fear and be happy at the same time. And so since fear is primarily absent from my life, I get to be primarily happy. But in the Jesus story, you know, at the beginning of his spiritual path, he went through this 40 days and 40 nights, and then he had a ministry, which in his case was a 3-year ministry. And near the end of that 3-year ministry, the fear started coming up again. And we see that in the Bible, starting in the last week of his life. In fact, the day after he entered Jerusalem, when he entered Jerusalem in the last week of his life, you know, everybody came out with the palm leaves. We call it Palm Sunday now, right? They come out with the palm leaves and hailed him as the King of the Jews. The very next day, the Bible says that Jesus woke up hungry. And it's funny because this is someone who went through 40 days and 40 nights in the desert without eating at all. But for some reason, the Bible says the next day that he woke up hungry. And then he sees a fig tree. And he goes to the fig tree to hopefully get some food. But there are no figs on this fig tree. And so Jesus becomes angry and he curses the fig tree. And the Bible even mentions, even though it wasn't the time of year for figs. You know, the Bible makes a point of telling us it was a very innocent fig tree. It wasn't even the time of year for figs. And here we have this hungry Jesus that gets angry and he curses this fig tree and it does die. And then that's the same day that Jesus goes into Jerusalem and he finds the money changers in the temple, which is something that he's seen before because it's always been there. But on this day, right, he gets angry. He turns over the tables and chases the money changers out of the temple. This to me is saying that that last bit of fear in Jesus that had not yet been healed in that initial purification was beginning to rise. And we see it show up first as anger. And anger, whenever you feel anger, if you investigate into that anger, what you are going to find is that underneath the anger, there's always fear. Anger, I always say anger is not at all a real emotion. It's an illusion. It's a defense mechanism, and it covers up fear. So when Jesus is angry at the fig tree and Jesus is angry at the money changers, what this means is that last remaining fear that did not get cleared out in that initial purification, that's now rising up. It's coming up. It's being pushed up so that it can be healed. So that final contamination can be removed and he can be truly enlightened, truly awake. And in fact, what really brings it to a head is that night in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he knows that the temple guards or the Roman guards, I think it was the temple guards actually, the temple guards are coming to arrest him. And again, I've been to the Garden of Gethsemane 3 times now. And when you're in the Garden of Gethsemane, you can look across the Kidron Valley to Jerusalem. Jesus would have been able to see them, assuming they were carrying torches, which they probably were. Jesus would have been able to see them making their way across the Kidron Valley, coming to the Garden of Gethsemane to arrest him. He would have known what was going on. You didn't even have to be psychic, right? You could see it coming. And so that fear of death, that fear of being arrested and being put to death, is what pushed up that remaining fear in Jesus. And if you read your Bible carefully, in the Garden of Gethsemane, the way it describes it was that he was in great fear. In fact, it even describes him as crying tears of blood because there was so much fear. The way the book of Mark tells the story, Jesus had to go in and out of the garden three times before he could really, really, truly let this go. And so the realization that came to me was that even though fear is not a great problem for me, just like it wasn't for Jesus during his three-year ministry, it was not a great problem. Just as Jesus still had some fear that needed to rise up and be released, that final contamination, the realization was that I still have this fear too. And this is a known thing. This isn't, the mind making stuff up. This is known. Like there's still some purification that needs to happen here. And so what happened when this realization came was, I'm going to call it open willingness and recognition. I have to call it open willingness and recognition that whenever this time comes and this final fear is pushed up, I want to make sure I remember how to purify. You know, at one time when I was going through that initial 5 years, would we say 1,825 days of purification, I had become a master at purification. I had become a master at rest, accept, and trust. I really knew how to not believe my mind, stay with the emotion, not believe the mind, and trust, and eventually even know that this was healing. But there was this thought that, you know, I haven't really had to do that a lot. I want to make sure that I'm not growing weak. I want to make sure that my muscles that allow me to practice rest, accept, and trust and move through very strong emotional experiences in a healing way. I want to make sure those muscles aren't growing weak. And so what came was just to remember that healing still needs to happen here, and that when the opportunity comes, I want to embrace it as healing. What came was just to remember what I want most of all and not forget. What came was basically to remain ready. Remain ready and willing so that when that final purification is to occur, that I will embrace the beginning lessons and move through it like the heartfelt beginner that I was in the first 5 years. So again, the journal entry, apparently I was looking at that a little bit on March 4th, 2014, too, because the journal entry says there is still fear here. I feel it now. So it must have been coming up a little bit for some reason right then as I was contemplating it. I was feeling it. There is still fear here. I feel it now. For a time, it was most obvious, and I'm talking about, you know, during that 5-year purification period. For a time, it was most obvious. It was clear to me that I was in fear. And then it became less. Right after that 5-year purification period, there's a basically fearless way of living. For a time, it was most obvious, and then it became less. Now it remains subtle and not fully believed. It can even be ignored as wisdom is chosen over fear. But it is here. I can feel it. What is the cause of this fear? And the answer that comes to me when I ask that question now is still the belief that I am the body. That is the cause of the fear. And in fact, if we look at Jesus' life, we're going to see another parallel there, because that was also the cause of the fear that remained with him, which is why it took this threat of death, physical death, to push it up. What am I afraid of? I suppose the answer is not existing. Intellectually, that's not true. It's kind of funny. You know, like at an intellectual level, that fear doesn't seem to exist. But if you get right down to it, get beyond the intellect, that's the only thing I can see that would still be feared. It's that fear of not existing. Or another way of putting it is that fear of not being me. But that me is a me. It's an ego me, but it's a me that's beyond just Regina. You know, it's not the fear of Regina not existing. The me can let Regina go as long as there gets to be another me. As long as me gets to continue in some way, in some form. It's the fear of not being me, a me. I'm going to call it a me, because again, it doesn't have to be Regina. Just as long as there's a me. So it's the fear of not existing. Who is afraid? Well, the first answer that comes is I am. So I'm just going to ask, what is this I, or who is this I that is afraid? And what I seem to see is a thought. But it's a root or a core thought. It's very ingrained. But it's still just a thought. It's still just a thought. So then the next question in the journal is, what am I? What am I? And when I ask, what am I? The honest feeling that I get. The best way to describe it is it's a non-attached self. It's not attached to anything. You could call it a floating self, but I don't mean like, you know, like a bodiless floating spirit or anything like that. It's not attached to anything. And so it's not attached to even this core thought. This core, I am the body thought. and therefore it is fully capable of remaining free and unattached as this thought, I want to say, suffers and dies. It can watch the anguish. And not interfere and allow it to happen. In other words, it is the queen of rest, accept, and trust. So again, the quote that we have been looking at is, one's true self shines forth again when the contamination is removed. And the journal entry says, there is still fear here. I feel it now. For a time it was most obvious, and then it became less. Now it remains subtle and not fully believed. It can even be ignored, as wisdom is chosen over fear. But it is here. I can feel it. What is the cause of this fear? What am I afraid of? Who is afraid? What am I? And with that completed, I'm going to move on to 771. In the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, says, eliminate completely your self-identification with this body. Ha, 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 ha. Don't you think that's funny? How the next quote knew that if we really contemplated the first quote, what we would see is that the core thought is identification with the body. The core fear is identification with the body. You know, and below that, just the me. Right? The identification with a me. And so the next quote starts right there. You know, I always think it's funny how when we really take the time to contemplate these quotes, we get to what we need in order to go into the next quote. They're like a progression. And in that way, the quotes just keep carrying us further and further and further and further. So 771, eliminate completely your self-identification with this body, and with determination, see that your mind is devoted to the removal of all ideas of additions to your true self. Eliminate completely your self-identification with this body, and with determination, see that your mind is devoted to the removal of all ideas of additions to your true self. This is an incredible commitment. But again, it's one that I would hope that we would all make. But it's the opposite of believing our opinions and believing our desires and believing our fears and believing our points of view, believing our thoughts, whatever they are. How How can we become so fully committed that we are just willing to disregard the ego in our own mind, regardless of the circumstance, regardless of what it's saying? How can we become so committed? Because that's what we need. It can't be something that we just kind of want to do. Because the ego is much too tricky for that. We have to be so incredibly committed that no matter what we might lose, we want to be free of the ego enough that we're willing to lose it, whatever it is. Peace Pilgrim said, "The ego knows the weakest spot in your armor. That weakest spot in our armor would be whatever we value more than awakening." Whatever we value more than awakening, regardless of what it is, it doesn't matter what it is. Whatever we value more than awakening, that's exactly what the ego is going to use to keep us in its grips, which really means to keep our attention sucked into it. So if my child is the thing that I value more than awakening, there will be fears about the child. There will be problems with the child. There will be dire circumstances with the child. Dire circumstances with the child to keep my attention sucked into thinking about the child, because that's the weakest spot in my armor. If the weakest spot in my armor is, if what I value more than awakening is how others think of me, if for some reason that's what's really important, then there's going to be circumstances. Sometimes they're going to seem like extreme circumstances where my reputation is really, really, really on the line. You know, I could be so, you know, somebody's going to accuse me of something terrible and everybody's going to be believing them. And it's just, you know, it's even going to be in the news. It's going to be in CNN. It's going to be in Fox. My reputation is really, really, really on the line here. So that the ego can get me sucked back into that problem. And how can I save my reputation? And the ego doesn't play lightly. This is what we need to be prepared for. It plays hardball. Because it thinks it's fighting for its life. It thinks it's the me that more than anything is afraid of not existing. It thinks it's a me. And so it takes great commitment, great desire to want awakening more than anything. And that's what it requires. Because again, if we hold one thing out, that's what the ego will use against us. To suck our attention into it again. Eliminate completely your self-identification with this body, and with determination, see that your mind is devoted to the removal of all ideas of additions to your true self. All right, let's look at the journal entry, also from March 4th, 2014. Fear can only come from one cause, being identified with the mind that is identified with the body. Spirit doesn't really identify with the body. Spirit identifies with the mind, which identifies with the body. And you could substitute the word attention here. If the word spirit is confusing for you, you could say attention doesn't really identify with the body. Attention identifies with the mind, which identifies with the body. The mind identifies with the body and thinks about the body, but spirit or attention is engrossed by mind. What if spirit was not engrossed by mind, but instead directed mind? Can the mind, which seems to keep spirit captive, be used to free spirit back into itself? That's a marvelous question. Can the mind, which seems to keep spirit captive, be used to free spirit back into itself? And the answer to that question is yes. Yes. Absolutely. So the only question is, what am I doing with the mind? Am I letting the mind seem to run me, the me in this sentence being attention? Am I letting the mind tell me, you know, how to feel, tell me what to focus my attention on? Is the mind talking and I'm the slave to the mind? Or am I remembering that I want to be free of mind and then using the mind to become free through practices like contemplation, inquiry, meditation, and remaining focused on attention or awareness instead of being focused on mind? I think that's all there is to say about that one. Am I using the mind to become free? That's the question. Or am I still letting the mind use me? I'm going to move on to 772. has an A, a B, and a C, so we'll see. We may not get through it all, but let's find out. So quote 772, so long as even a dreamlike awareness of yourself as an individual in the world remains, a wise person persistently see to the removal of all ideas of additions to your true self. I'll read that again. So long as even a dreamlike awareness of yourself as an individual in the world remains, has a wise person persistently see to the removal of all ideas of additions to your true self. Now, if I am 100% honest with you, and I don't want to be anything less than that, my current experience is, I'm going to call it wavering. My current experience is wavering. Sometimes I feel like a real person in a real world. Typically at the level of discernment. And what I mean by that is being, you know, trying to pay attention within and noticing what is ego, so that I can not listen to it. But still, a person in the world. So that's an experience that I have part of the time. I also have experiences now where the world and the idea that I'm a person in the world is genuinely very dreamlike. It doesn't, even though the experience is here, it doesn't seem real, dreamlike. So the experience is still here, but it doesn't seem real. And so I waver back and forth between those two perceptions of a real person in a world practicing discernment, and both the idea that I'm a person in a world, both of them seeming very dreamlike, not seeming real. So what's interesting about this quote, since I have these experiences that I just told you about, it says, so long as even a dreamlike awareness of yourself as an individual in the world remains. So let's just imagine for a moment that, you know, my progression continues, my awakening progression continues, and I get to the point where I am no longer wavering, but I always have that sense, and it's a genuine sense when it's here, it's not artificial. I always have that sense that this idea that I'm Regina and that this world is real is, you know, I mean, it just doesn't seem real. It seems more dreamlike. It seems unreal. I don't know how else to explain it. Let's imagine for a moment that I get to where that's my consistent experience. I would imagine that some people call that awake, that consistent experience. But notice this says, so long as even a dreamlike awareness of yourself as an individual in the world remains, as a wise person persistently see to the removal of all ideas of additions to your true self. So in other words, nothing has changed. What I called the beginner practices a while ago, those beginner practices, you know, still have to be used. We recently read from NTI, if you're in the Gentle Healing Group, and we read how the phase one on the spiritual path is the loosening of thoughts in your mind that you've believed heavily until now. And then phase two is the letting go of those thoughts. But NTI is very clear, in phase two, additional loosening also has to happen. So just because you move from the loosening to the letting go doesn't mean the loosening is done. So in phase two, what's happening is loosening and letting go, right? And then you move on to phase three, which NTI calls service. That's when you are really just getting to where you're listening to the right mind instead of the wrong mind, and you're demoting your self-will, and you're just listening to the right mind. That's your goal at this point, listening to the right mind and not listening to the personal self-mind at all. But NTI says in this phase, loosening and letting go also still has to continue, right? So it's not like you've graduated from the loosening and the letting go, even though you're at the point now where you're practicing, you know, as the Course would say, listening to only one voice, listening to only the right mind and not listening to the ego at all. And if we went on to read 1 Corinthians, which at some point we will, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, it talks about the fourth phase. And the fourth phase is when the struggle with the ego has ended, right? But it says even in this, and you know that you're in a dream. It's very clear about that. You know that you're in a dream. And it says, however, the purpose has not changed. In other words, the loosening and the letting go is still continuing, even though you're in this phase now where you know you're in a dream. And that's exactly what this quote says from Sankara. So long as even a dreamlike awareness of yourself as an individual in the world remains, as a wise person persistently see to the removal of all ideas of additions to your true self. So that just continues and continues and continues, right? Until there's, as NTI says, until there's nothing left to let go of. NTI says something like, your purpose is to keep letting go until there's nothing left to let go of. That's in NTI Revelation chapter 1. So we only have 4 minutes left, but let's go ahead and look at 772A. 772A says, we want to see ourselves as done. We want to claim wisdom or enlightenment. But who wants to make this claim? Who wants to see itself in this way? NTI says, you are not complete until you are the truth. It also says, you must walk until your end. I cannot explain these words, but I understand them. I intend to walk the path as a gift to myself until there is no one left to walk and no path to walk on. I'm going to read that again. We want to see ourselves as done. We want to claim wisdom or enlightenment. But who wants to make this claim? Who wants to see itself in this way? NTI says, you are not complete until you are the truth. It also says, you must walk until your end. I cannot explain these words, but I understand them. I intend to walk the path as a gift to myself until there is no one left to walk and no path to walk on. And actually, with 2 minutes left, I'm going to go ahead and go to 772B. 772B says, who am I? What answers does the mind provide to this question? What answers do I believe but not see? Who do I think I am that keeps the sense of me in place? Can I be more alert to mind's definitions of me? Can I see the definitions mind offers so I am no longer fooled into believing those ideas are me? So that's some pretty good inquiry there. It's really looking beyond the obvious. What is in here that's subtle and kind of overlooked by my awareness, kind of overlooked as a definition that I'm still holding on to, which still keeps me as a me? Right? What am I identifying with? Am I a nice person, for example? Am I a giving person? Am I a selfish person? Am I a busy person? Am I a victim? Am I slower than others? Am I smarter than others? Am I talented in some way? Am I lacking some talent? What are those identifications that I still carry around with me? That's what this 772B is asking us to look at. And I think next week I will begin here with 772B. We'll just start here and we'll continue looking at this particular quote. For now, I'm going to let go of the mic and I will be back in half an hour. So I'll see you all then. Bye.